If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
If a contract has gotten to that level of litigation, it was a terrible contract. It was a terrible deal in the first place. So it's not who wins. It's like everybody's lost. A pox on all houses.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Alex Talcott is an active and passive real estate investor from New Hampshire. He teaches finance and business law at the University of New Hampshire. Hey, Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Oh, man, it's great. It's great to have you on here. I'm excited about our conversation today. The basic flow of the show, you know, we say this to everybody that comes on, is where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there? Can you kind of share with our listeners that journey for you?
Yeah, I was born on a cold winter day, like for real, in January. And I dig the cold. I'm a north of the Mason-Dixon guy talking to a good old boy from Memphis. But yeah, I live in New Hampshire now. So not to totally fast forward the first part of my life, I guess, New York to New Hampshire, but it felt like a sprint because there is a certain pace to New York City. I still talk really fast as a result. Pretty competitive environment, Long Island, New York, where I grew up academically. By the time I got to my dream school in New Hampshire and met my dream woman when I was 18, 20 plus years later, I'm still in New Hampshire with a few detours along the way. But maybe the New York to New Hampshire narrative is, I mean, geez, that might be 80% of the story right there.
Right. Okay. So dig in, give us some details on that. And then, you know, again, tell us some things that you've learned in your real estate journey.
Yeah. So, I mean, coming up to New Hampshire, part of it was going to a school that had small class sizes, having really deep conversations. The first in the nation presidential primary was a part of it. I've always been a very civic guy. And at this point in my career, I actually have a politics and property practice within my company, where we do a variety of bill monitoring and advocacy related to property rights and property opportunities. So finding those connections between government, smaller communities, individual liberty, family, friends, those have been kind of liberal arts concerns of mine that I wanted to really accelerate. And Dartmouth College was a fantastic college for that. I studied religion there. My wife studied economics. And then we sort of switched. She became a social worker, and I went into financial services law, production as a financial advisor, and increasingly more investment of private capital in real estate.
How did you make that transition from a religions major to what you do today? I mean, that's an interesting switch.
Yeah, it depends on who I'm telling, right? So you can always say, oh, it was all about ethics. I've always been, you know, deeply interested in matters of ethics, which is absolutely true. Because after majoring in religion, I went to Notre Dame for law school, where their moniker is educating a different kind of lawyer, which kind of throws a lot of shade at lawyers, right? That they're educating a different kind that is, you know, concerned with the higher callings and responsibilities of a fiduciary at law. But for me, frankly, it was a matter of just going to a place where I could read the oldest, hardest stuff with the smartest, most challenging faculty, who my wife jokes sometimes that I'm not very open to feedback. But I mean, there was a time, and there are certain people who I'm extremely receptive to honest feedback from and steering and direction about, ooh, you're onto something here. That's interesting. Yeah, there are 10 books about that already. Go read up on it, and then you can ask me a question. So I really liked humbling myself before people who had read and thought quite a bit more than I had.
Sure.
During my teenage and early 20s years.
So you went to Notre Dame Law, and then you got you graduated with your law degree from Notre Dame. And then when did you really make the transition into real estate of any capacity?
While I was in law school over the summers, I was fortunate. Both my 1L and 2L summers, I was with a small firm that had a real estate practice. And even then, the real estate practice had quite a bit to do with municipal codes and zoning in suburban areas. So I thought that was really neat. I also really associate that time where I was doing some insurance law, and then the firm I practiced with for 3 years out of law school, with forming a lot of my real estate skill set even though the underlying investments and investment companies that I was representing were insurance companies and broker dealers, because where I am now is I like to think about real estate in the context of things that are readily available in the public capital markets. So a lot of people in real estate are really, really afraid of the stock market. And maybe they wind up there because it's so tangible and they're told that the stock market is so volatile. I am super comfortable with the stock market. I still carry my Series 7 and my Series 66, and I'm actively investing in that space. Real estate just does some different things for me.
Right, right. Okay. So what do you do now? Can you define that for us?
Sure. Educator, attorney, entrepreneur.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. So I teach about two classes a semester, 6 minutes that way at the University of New Hampshire's Business School. I teach a variety of courses in finance and business law at the undergraduate and graduate levels. That's really important to me. Since I have that ivory tower affiliation, it really incentivizes me to just fill the top of the funnel with information and say, hey, if this stuff's a little bit too crazy for what I might do in my businesses this week, well, I can prepare the next generation for stuff that might be relevant to them in a half generation.
Right.
I love teaching. It really subsidizes the futurism, the absent-minded professorism. I love that. That's a really important part of my life. And then I'm still a licensed and practicing attorney. I have a private client practice, and I do a lot of negotiation of my own real estate contracts and real estate contracts for other people. And then I'm also affiliated with a broker dealer as a financial planning specialist and managing partner of a $600 million financial advisory shop.
Wow. That's a lot of being pulled in a lot of different directions all at once. How do you have time to sleep?
I sleep more than my wife does. We have 6-year-old twins and a 3-year-old and a dog and a cat that I'm allergic to. I'm allergic to the dog and the cat, not the twins and the 3-year-old. But yeah, I mean, she's incredible. You know, she's been my thinking and planning and dreaming partner for 2 decades. So she's irreplaceable.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, it's definitely a team sport. So you mentioned when you're doing your attorney work, you're basically one of your own best clients, it sounds like. I mean, you're using what you know to advance your real estate holdings. Is that right?
Yeah, when I was in law school, the most challenging course for me as a first year law student was contracts. And I've heard this from quite a lot of lawyers that the area that is most challenging for you in advanced study sometimes becomes your area of specialty. So there was like a reason that it was hard for me, like, and I was onto something. So that's a really, that's an interesting dichotomy. Or my last name's Talcott, so I call them Talcottomies. It's, you know, sometimes you try to, like I was saying, you want to take that feedback of what you're onto, what you're really good at, and hone in on that. But what about the fact that I just revealed that a number of my lawyer friends find that it was a good struggle that they were having with something. You know, it's who is it who said that it's a good idea to have a lover's quarrel with your own country? That was like, I don't know who that was, Robert Frost or somebody, maybe it's Mark Twain, the idea that, you know, you can be a patriot and you can still have a lover's quarrel with something you really care about. I don't know if I would have called it a lover's quarrel with contracts, but I really, really enjoy the combination of a spoken communication and writing, coming up with the, you know, winning and coming up with the win-wins. I just love it. And I think I have maybe a different view of contracts. I think this is a little bit of what it was. Law school contracts is all about what contracts are valid, enforceable, if it went to the extreme of like appellate review. And of course, if a contract has gotten to that level of litigation, it was a terrible contract. It was a terrible deal in the first place. So it's not who wins. It's like everybody's lost, a pox on all houses.
Right.
So for me, you know, contracts as communication tools that build trust and work towards getting things done, getting to yes is what it's all about. It's not who's no, who's wrong, who gets punished by a lawyer. Ugh, that stinks. So I really like that positive, proactive aspect of contract negotiation.
Right, right. Yeah, I can't think there's not many of us that think, oh, let's read a contract to see what good things are in it.
Oh, yeah.
There's usually read contracts to find out how you might get screwed.
Oh, that's amazing. Because like, I mean, if you talk about like 80-20 rule type stuff, if you're actually reading a contract that's already been drafted, 80% is what, like a B minus? But that's awesome. That's a starting point. There's probably some stuff in there. It's much easier to look at a contract that's been drafted than to look at a blank Word document with a cursor. So give me a contract any day. That's an amazing starting point.
Yeah, you can always mark up and change the contract that's in front of you. That's interesting.
Yeah, I got one right there that I'm going to be doing right after I talk with you.
Awesome. Yeah, I guess that's one of the other things that I think is interesting is playing to your strengths. I mean, you love that stuff. Like, I'll read a contract because I have to. You know, I'm probably one of the few people, I think, when I get a PPM, what was that? I had an investor call here recently where they said, you're the only person that's ever read all 180 pages of this and then come back with questions. I'm like, hey, you know, page 85, you know, point D, subsection 4, it says this. What's that mean? And they're like,
Yeah, I mean, I sent an email last night that was redirecting a banker's attention to page 6 that just straight up had the rents on a 4 unit. So at night on a holiday, you know, I get an email saying, oh, is this like an unrented property? I was like, no, it's 4 for 4 rented. And it's not that far into the PDF that I sent along that has them right there. It's a really good deal. Here's a deal on a platter.
Right. No, that's interesting. What are you currently buying?
Let's do where I'm buying, because I think that's maybe the most interesting flip that's happened in the last few months in my own state. So I was this, and I'm in New Hampshire, man. You know, I'm not in that Smile State region. It's not warm and sunny here. Sometimes it's sunny, but that just makes the snow reflect in your eyes and it makes it very difficult to ski. But yeah, we got outbid our company on properties in Indiana and Missouri. And I just had to make sure that I wasn't overlooking some opportunities in my own backyard. You know, I was an early evangelist, super comfortable investing outside of my geographic market. But it got to a point where things were getting pricey nationally in a number of markets that I frankly shouldn't have thought we'd be getting outbid on. That really encouraged me to relook in my own backyard and to see what's going on here in New Hampshire. And so I live in what's called the Seacoast area. I live in Durham, which is home of the State University, and it's really close to mountains and beaches, and I got a river right there. It's a beautiful, wonderful place. But people do indeed live in the northern part of the state. There are some lower middle to middle class areas with really great salt of the earth granite staters who live in among the oldest housing stock in the country, which is statistically true in New Hampshire. We have the oldest housing stock. But there are not low vacancy problems in any of those more rural areas. So there are opportunities to come in and to manage, forget pre-1978, we're talking 19th century properties. I had an 1840 construction property inspected last week that we're going to do a great job with.
Wow. Wow. And what are these single families that you guys are buying? Are they apartment complexes?
No, these are multis. Yeah. So, you know, 3 and 4 unit properties. So, you know, we can get commercial financing from some good regional banks who are kind of appreciative that we're coming to be positive partners in the community. And when people hear that maybe a semi-slick, fast-talking guy is coming to town, but he's not a flipper. Oh, he's a buy and hold? All right.
Right. Now that's fascinating. You're talking about buying a quadplex from the 1840s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not even sure. I mean, obviously people were in Tennessee at that point in time, but I don't think I've ever even seen a house here that...
Yeah, Davy Crockett showed up, right?
He did. Yeah, sure. I'm sure there's...
Where he peaced out. You know, he was there for a hot minute.
He was. No, that's fascinating. That is fascinating. So you guys are going into these smaller towns in New Hampshire and then buying quadplexes.
I'll take a duplex. I'll take I have a duplex in one town up north that is in a opportunity zone. And one of the things I really like about the opportunity zone opportunities is that while they call them qualified opportunity funds, you don't have to become like this enormous fund manager who has like all these properties within a thing. Maybe you need to do that if you're pitching like coastal big money or something. But I have a duplex that is in a standalone qualified opportunity fund.
How do you make that work? I have no idea what that, like, obviously you think of OZ areas and you're like, hey, you know, you're thinking 10, 20, $30 million projects, not duplexes.
No, not something that I picked up for under $60,000.
Right. So what's the advantage to you? Walk us through that deal and why that even makes sense.
All the money that I put into it, that is a capital gain. In this case, from 2019, not even from 2020, I do a 10-year buy and hold. I double the basis over a coherent 35-month period. And those capital gains are not just deferred, they are destroyed.
Right. So gone. you've got free income coming in off of those properties.
Yeah, well, or at least the money that went into it. So there's the money that's generated by it, and then the money that goes into it. At this point, I'm still early enough into this particular project that I'm just thinking about the beautiful, you know, legal wash of money that went into it.
Right. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. What do you teach at school?
Yeah, so business law is one of my go-tos at the University of New Hampshire, not at the law school, but at the business school. There are two of us who come in and teach the business law classes. There's myself and a gentleman who's affiliated as an in-house counsel at Liberty Mutual. So we teach those classes. And then in the finance space, the course that I've taught the most times at UNH is Introduction to Financial Management, which is at its core a corporate finance course. But I teach what I consider three legs of a stool: corporate finance, government finance, and personal finance, as a true introductory, diversified, useful for yourself, your family, your community, your society, understanding of financial management. And then I'll do fintech courses at the graduate level, corporate financial strategy for MBA or MS in finance students.
That's interesting. My goodness gracious. Yeah, I can't even imagine what those courses would look like. I rode the short bus and was probably the dumbest kid in class. So it, those types of things kind of go over my head.
I don't even know what the courses look like. That's the whole point, actually. I'm very whimsical, or I like to think so. So my courses are upwards of 60% current events ripped from the headlines.
Interesting.
So let's say Turkey hacked JP Morgan Chase yesterday. That's what class is going to be about.
That's interesting. That's interesting. And how do you tie that back to, you know, real estate, to law, to finance? Like how do you tie all those back in?
Yeah, well, I mean, real estate finance benefits from having an understanding of capital markets. And I take a very broad view of capital markets. And so I like to joke with my students that one example of a capital market that's probably not mentioned in your textbook, but is a really good one, is called college buddies. So I'm not saying like burn up your phone and sell them steak knives and painting and you know, whole life insurance. But really, if you build a network of people who think well of you, they may be clients and collaborators in the future. They might be some great investors of capital in things that you do. And so, yeah, a lot of real estate finance is not working up the guts to call up a bank or visit a bank. A lot of it is, you know, personal network capital. So I love talking about that.
Right. And has that been one of the keys that's helped you scale your real estate investments?
I think, you know, something that, you know, to gush on your show a bit is how to scale commercial real estate. For a lawyer and a teacher, I'm always like, ooh, but I also want to do, what are we scaling and when are we scaling it? And why are we scaling it? And you answer a lot of those questions in your conversations as well. But in the executive entrepreneurs program, in 3 years of it with Strategic Coach, my two favorite books that I've read, one is Always Be the Buyer. My second favorite is Who Not How. And so for me, when you say how to scale commercial real estate, for me, you know, how has been flipping to who more and more. It doesn't have the same ring to it to call a variation on your show that I would host would be like, with whom do you scale commercial real estate?
And then we rewound 200 years.
Yes. So the with whom or the who questions are the area where I'm maybe a contrarian in terms of my scaling. So for me, it's not scaling the door count or the size of each property. I'm really interested in scaling my headcount in-house. So yesterday we hired team member number 20 in-house. I've seen a lot of real estate capital companies kind of max out most at one, plenty at two or three, and you can draw the curve from there before you get like mega institutional. While I'm down with technology, love me some algorithms, do not fear our robot overlords in the least, bring it Skynet, I'm ready. I saw Terminator 2 on Laserdisc, so I've been ready for a while. I also, I love humans. Love me some humans. Love my students, former students, other people who I tend to find or tend to find me. So I'm really interested in scaling out a lot of our real estate on the basis of quality human capital who can do great research, who can answer questions that I might propound and might become more and more curious, critical thinkers who can ask a lot of interesting questions to propel our company forward.
Right, right. And so let's go back and forgive me for my ignorance, but your company now, you've got 20 people, you're scaling your headcount. What is it that your company is doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have the benefit of private capital. You know, will we do some joint ventures? Sure. Do we want to make sure that we're always staying on the compliance side of everything we're doing? Of course we are. I'm a trained FINRA arbitrator and chairperson. I'm licensed out the wazoo. So I'm very, very mindful about doing that right. My partner is a fellow attorney as well. We have two other legal analysts on the team. You know, how many lawyers does it take to buy a single family? As like the setup of like a joke, but we really are very, very thoughtful about doing things right and doing a lot of things really right. And so, yeah, we're doing joint ventures, but from the capital standpoint, you know, we're pretty blessed. You know, you hear about family offices. I've always had this idea that it would be neat to build a friend office where more people had access to opportunities and equity earlier in their career. I have a certain diversity impulse where I would like to see a variety of underrepresented minorities have opportunities to own stuff. If we look out in Silicon Valley, the last statistic I saw is woman ownership of private equity out there is like 9%. Should it be 50 or 51%? I don't know, but 9 is wrong. So I want to do what I can to have people of color, women, all orientations understand the power of ownership towards building substantial wealth and freedom. So there are equity opportunities really, really early for what we call affiliate analysts.
So that was going to be my next question. How do you go about implementing that and stay compliant? Because that's one of the things that I think unfortunately keeps a lot of people out is the rules and regulations that surround them.
Yeah, the same thing that scares people out of the stock market into real estate. Well, not the same thing, but a different thing. They get a lot of people wind up in real estate because they get scared out of the real estate market, but then they get scared out of taking action by some of the already scaled players who can afford an SEC attorney because they're so afraid of being on the wrong side of somebody, be it a government agency, a self-regulating organization, their own clients or customers or what have you. You know, we're not fundraisers. So, you know, joint ventures are not securities. You know, if you stay on the right side of the most relevant court case that determines what a investment contract is among the obvious securities of stocks and bonds, it's called the Howey test. So that's another example of why it's nice to be a lawyer. You know, you read the pages of contracts more meticulously than most. You do your due diligence, and I do too. I've read the court case and the relevant case law. So I know what we can do, what we can't do. And again, a lot of things in the law want people to be active in society. So it's the same view that I have about contracts is the view that I have about other types of commerce. I was working on something recently that involved the UK, and it really wasn't as easy as it should have been. And my mindset going into this was, well, we just got to figure this out, like me and the other companies over there, because the United States and the UK, we're supposed to have what's known as a special relationship.
Sure.
So this has to work. So some of the things, you know, it's not like if we can be in business together across the Atlantic, it's how can we be in business? And as soon as I figure out how to do more and better globally, that's going to be a really nice thing for my group too, because I love it when my junior analysts wind up decades, years, or months advance. I love the second I learn something, second it's in here, it's out here, you know, to my people.
No, that's awesome. That is awesome. No, I've loved this conversation. Let's jump into the final four if we can. Take everything you know, and you've got, you know, quite the varied background from an educator to entrepreneur, attorney, broker, dealer. Take all those different facets that you're involved in, and you're going to give one piece of advice to an aspiring investor. What's that one piece of advice?
Do you have a Roth IRA?
Interesting. Okay. Explain.
I can talk myself and other people in circles, but there are certain first steps that will probably not involve much or any exposure to real estate that I like people to own in their personal finance realm. So if you are under 50 and you can put away up to $500 a month in an account that will grow tax-free and be tax-free upon withdrawal, at which time you'll probably be in a higher tax bracket, and the tax rates and the tax brackets will probably be higher. That's a really, really good thing to own. So anytime the government is forsaking certain revenue by way of capital gains tax or any other tax, I don't see the, can I afford to save $500 into a Roth if I'm income qualified as the question. The question is really more of a signal from the government that you can't afford not to. Like that's where it starts. I don't really like to entertain speculation in real estate or even cash flow investing in real estate unless I have some sense that people are taking advantage of a Roth IRA opportunity. The second piece would be if you got a 401k match, that's maybe a 100% return on your money. And that may not involve real estate. So love real estate, but it might not be the first or second thing that you do. So there might be some binary do this first points of advice before it's really fun to get in the weeds with people about what's an IRR, what's a submarket. Sure.
No, that's awesome. That's awesome. What's one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
I'm not on a treadmill right now while I'm talking with you, but I would say maybe 70% of my communications the last several months have been on the go. I'm either on a treadmill, I'm walking outside. A lot of my friends and yours, I'm sure as well, are, or maybe you're a former student athlete too. I don't even know. I have so many associates in this business who are accomplished athletes to varying extents, which I'm not. I'm a jock sniffer. I'm just a huge fan. So if they're getting in those kinds of steps to keep weight off some pretty huge frames to avoid or to win the battle of the bulge, just walking as fast as I talk is something that I'm trying to do.
Right. That's awesome. When it comes to giving back, what's one thing you're doing to make the world a better place?
I'm really proud to be on the Governor's Council on Housing Stability here in New Hampshire. I was appointed a few weeks ago, and I'm on two of the subcommittees. One is a regional subcommittee or working group that I wanted to be on as a guy who lives in one part of the state and invests in another. And the other is planning and regulatory. I'm the one co-chair of the planning and regulatory group who does not work for the state. So as a representative of the private sector, just better informing the state on what would it take to attract more capital and cooperation in underserved areas that don't have sufficient affordable housing, that may have higher rates of homelessness. I love being a private sector volunteer in my home state of New Hampshire in that regard.
Right. No. And we need more of that. We need more of that. Cause there's, I think like you said, there's so little of it that, yeah, that's awesome. Good for you for doing that.
Yeah. More government councils need entrepreneurs who rock hoodies.
That's correct. That's correct. I love that. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah. Check me out on Instagram, Lex Dan. I'm the Alex of Lex Dan, and Daniel Barley is an outstanding real estate attorney and investor and educator. And we formed Lex Dan in the summer of 2019. And if you go to Lex Dan RE at LexDanRe on Instagram, you'll see some pictures that tease out what we're up to.
That's awesome. Alex, thanks so much for your time today. This was awesome. I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.